From the CME Group Research to Practice, this is Beyond the Guidelines, PARP Inhibitors in the Management of Ovarian Cancer, a virtual satellite event to the 2020 Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting, originally planned for Toronto. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love with a roundtable discussion featuring faculty members Drs. Rob Coleman, Stephanie LaRue, Joyce Liu, and Katie Moore. For presentations and interviews with the faculty, please go to researchtopractice.com/SGO2020satellites. Prior to this event, we conducted a survey of 25 gynecologic and medical oncology investigators and also 50 community-based physicians and meeting registrants, querying them about their usual practice patterns in the disease. During the roundtable discussion, we discussed these clinical issues and a number of faculty cases, beginning with Dr. Liu.
So this was a 58-year-old woman. She presented with advanced stage 3 disease. Her surgeon took her for a primary cytoreductive surgery, so she had optimal cytoreductive surgery, although she did require several bowel resections with primary anastomoses for this. And she started on adjuvant chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel in that setting. I actually, at our institution, we can send somatic testing as well as germline testing. So I sent off both somatic testing and germline testing basically at the same time. And her somatic testing came back first and actually turned out to have no evidence of a BRCA mutation. But then her germline testing came back with this deletion in exon 3, basically full deletion of exon 3, which was quite interesting to see. Given this, I actually went back to our internal folks. I asked them to look at the next-gen sequencing. And it turns out that, in fact, on the next-gen sequencing assay, you could see the deletion in exon 3, but you couldn't call it because of the amount of artifacts. So they could not actually make that call without having the test from the germline to make the call. And so she finished her chemotherapy. She was in remission, so I started her on maintenance olaparib.
And how long has she been on treatment, and how's she doing?
She's doing okay on maintenance olaparib. She's been only on it for a couple of months, so this was a pretty recent occasion, but she's doing well on therapy.
I'm just kind of curious with her. Any GI problems? There were a lot of questions about preemptive medication. Any problem with her?
No, she's actually been tolerating it okay. I mean, she had a little bit of nausea, but not anything sort of significant. I give people a Compazine script that they can fill and sort of take if they have nausea, but I don't tell people to take it, you know, prophylactically before every dose. Fine with it.
Katie, any comments? You know, you see all kinds of weird BRCA stuff, and, you know, here's another example of it. How do you figure out whether or not it's something that, you know, would respond to a PARP inhibitor?
Well, fortunately, the assays that are available will tell us whether it's a deleterious mutation or not. And so you have to be careful. And we're pretty good at calling variants. And so variants, at least if we're talking about using PARP inhibitors for patients with BRCA mutations, either germline or somatic, we can figure that out well from the assays. I think Dr. Liu's case really nicely and somewhat concerningly, that's not a word, illustrates our challenge right now, because from a cost effectiveness standpoint, sending the tumor first and then reflexing to germline makes a lot of sense. Yeah. But we know from SOLO-1, where we knew everybody's germline, but when we looked at the next gen sequencing, we missed 5%, mainly these large rearrangements and call frequencies. So you miss 5% of your germline patients, which is kind of critical, was critical for getting them a PARP inhibitor until 2 weeks ago, but also very critical for cascade testing and preventing these tumors in relatives. So this is a great case that illustrates the need for both for now.
So before Rob, I'm going to ask you to comment, but I just want to, a question that came in that I think might be almost beginning of a theme. Here's a verbatim a question. Given the highly evolving space of frontline maintenance of ovarian cancer, does a biomarker-driven approach make the most sense in light of the recent approval? So we'll just sort of keep that question in the back of our mind. Rob, take a look at this second case of Joyce's, another interesting situation as it relates to testing. Joyce, what happened with this 52-year-old woman?
So this is a 52-year-old woman. She came in with advanced disease. She actually had ascites and was recommended for neoadjuvant chemo. She had a really nice response to that, went for surgery, had an optimal IBS with a complete pathologic response in her omental disease, although she did have some residual high-grade serous carcinoma involving both tubes and ovaries. She got three additional cycles of adjuvant carboplatin and paclitaxel. She had germline testing first. That was negative for a BRCA mutation, and I actually sent her for a Myriad My Choice test, and she actually came back with a high genomic instability score. So given that by the Myriad test, she tested positive for HRD, I actually put her on maintenance niraparib. Mm-hmm.
So again, we're going to look at what your colleagues are doing in this situation. But Rob, any comments about this case?
The one variable that you could have considered here is whether or not the patient would have gotten bevacizumab during the induction treatment. That would have opened up some options as of 2 weeks ago. But I think our sense is that in the BRCA wild-type HRD patient population, we have seen objective responses in the recurrent setting, and we have seen benefit to HRD, isolated HRD in the platinum-sensitive recurrent setting, and now it's been mirrored in the frontline setting as well.
So I want to talk a little bit about the survey and what we saw. And Stephanie, in general, what we saw in the investigators, in general, right now, there's in general, multi-gene panels are favored in terms of germline testing. Looks like almost everybody is doing multi-gene somatic. But where it gets interesting, I think, is HRD testing. So Stephanie, in general, and I'm just putting reimbursement issues aside because, every country is a little bit, sort of putting reimbursement issues aside, if you sort of get into the clinical science, what do you think is the optimal strategy, assuming the patient has no family history, for a patient presenting with ovarian cancer nowadays, Stephanie?
I think as we discussed, with Katie just discussed, I think the germline testing is very important because actually have impact for the patient, but also the family. And we talk a lot about the BRCA, but I think the panel is really probably the way to go because we begin to know that there's a lot of mutation beyond BRCA that are important, and we can cite PRBA2, RAD51. All these genes may have an impact, and I think prevention really still need to be our focus. So I think the germline testing with the panel is very important. In terms of the somatic testing, I'm glad that you say that it's regulation apart. I think the HRD testing may have some importance given we may have different benefit, but we don't know yet what is really the value of the HRD testing. Each institution may have their own HRD testing as well. All the trial use the same HRD testing, but actually we know that did not select all the population. So we were just talking about the fact that, somatic BRCA, we may miss 5%, but again, for the HRD testing, we miss much more than 5% of the patient may have benefit because the test is not completely accurate. Mm-hmm. So I think it's why the approval from FDA was regardless the HRD status, because right now the test can help to guide the treatment and the discussion with the patient, but are not completely sensitive and specific.
So we're going to actually get into some cases. There are a lot of questions about what do you do if they're HRD positive, negative. And we'll actually see that played out in terms of some of these questions. We'll also want to show you kind of the way the docs in practice, what they're doing. And you can see in general, it's pretty similar, maybe a little bit more BRCA germline than panel than in the investigators, but a lot of use of NGS. And Joyce, again, you see a minority of people using HRD assay. Your talk was really fantastic. I highly recommend people to go through Joyce's talk. One of the things you get into, Joyce, that I didn't realize was that HRD is like you call it a state, but that's not exactly what is being measured. Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah, and I think, Stephanie was alluding to this as well. I mean, HRD is really a state of the cell. Your cell can either repair DNA double-strand breaks by homologous recombination deficiency or can't. Like, that's true or not true. But all of our tests of HR deficiency right now, they're all sort of basically proxy tests. We're trying to guess what the true state of the cell is, and that state actually changes. So our tests aren't good. And I think that's why I totally agree with the statement that HRD testing right now gives us guidance. It might help you give guidance to a patient, but it's not a definitive yes or no. It's not like BRCA mutation. You know it's mutated or you know it's not. We can't directly test HRD right now.
And of course, like all assays in oncology, it has to be individualized to the patient. You know, is it going to really make a difference to what you do or not? That would have to be considered. Rob, you had a thought?
Yeah, I was going to say, to Joyce's statement, I think the analogy I always use is the smoke and fire. So the fire being HRD is being the homologous recombination. Smoke meaning that there's you know it was there at some point, and smoke can linger even though the fire may be out. So it's it's not specific enough to actually tell you, although it can potentially represent the incident.
I have to say, when I did the interview with Rob, he said, "Oh, I'm going to send you a couple papers to try to explain what I'm telling you about." You send me these two papers. I have no idea, Rob. I have no idea what those papers said. Just so you know.
I'm trying.
I'm glad somebody understands it, but it's not me. Anyhow, another issue, Stephanie, I wanted your thoughts on. You know, we hear about other germline mutations. We can go to the next slide here. And we asked our investigators, what about PALB2, RAD51C, and ATM? Now, sort of along the lines of, you know, what our questioner said, is it really relevant? But assuming you do want to know it, Stephanie, it looks like the faculty in general is kind of approaching these three germline mutations similarly to BRCA. Is that the way you approach them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think definitely. I think because BRCA, it's really well defined. And then after this BRCA, like what we call the HRD deficiency, is actually the difficulty to repair the DNA. And all these genes are involved in this repair of the homologous repair deficiency. So I think when we try to define the HRD, I think these genes are really in the pathway. So actually it makes completely sense to define them and treat them, consider as HRD deficiency.
So another question that we asked related to, as we go through this, we're going to bring up a few issues related to COVID, social distancing, et cetera. Katie, one of the questions we had was, is your approach to genetic counseling changing? And you can see that investigators in general say yes. And of course, when you ask them how it's changing, and the first thing everybody brings up nowadays is telehealth and telemedicine, et cetera. We saw that same thing in our docs in practice. Any comments about how you approach? I always thought, Katie, that we maybe should have used technology more in genetic counseling anyhow, you know, telemedicine, videos, et cetera. How has your approach to genetic counseling, Katie, changed, if at all? I know your area is not as affected as other areas, but in the last few weeks or a couple months, Katie.
Right. So we are very fortunate in Oklahoma to have been spared for the most part. So we've sort of been kind of business as usual. We have used more telehealth, and our patients who are frightened very much appreciate that. And so that's true for genetic counseling as well. So it hasn't tremendously shifted. Most of our visits are still in person, but maybe for a month we were using more telehealth. But I think we are going to keep telehealth because a lot of our patients really like it, and it is very helpful because now we couldn't bill before in my institution for telehealth. And so now all of a sudden we can do consults and we can do all of these things and actually bill. And so that's really helpful for our genetic counselors who are already underpaid, but they can do some more telehealth visits and see patients really on schedule. And there's been nice work from across the US. The West Clinic in Memphis has shown this, and you know, other institutions, I think any of us could rattle those off, have really demonstrated that this is a very effective way to appropriately counsel families about genetic risk. And so this epidemic, which is terrible on every level, there are some silver linings, and a lot of our institutions have rapidly do things that we've always wanted to do, like telemedicine and reducing unnecessary visits and clinical trials. I could go on that are going to stay, and I think will benefit our patients tremendously. And telehealth is one of them. Genetic counseling, pre-chemo visits, blah, so many things.
But let's stay back to the nitty-gritty here And the real question that people want to get into, which is, what are we going to do now in terms of upfront therapy? And before we start to go through various scenarios, I want to hear a case from Katie. But before we get into that, Joyce, could you just summarize the two recent approvals that came out that now are causing everybody to really think deeply about what to do, so to speak?
Yeah, so quite hot off the press. So it's probably about, what, 3-4 weeks ago now, maybe less than that. Twice in COVID. That niraparib was approved off of the PRIMA data for women who had responded to frontline platinum-based chemotherapy. And so that was approved as single-agent maintenance across the board, regardless of biomarker, for women with advanced ovarian cancer. And then, you know, just last week, maybe, based off of PAOLA-1, the combination of bevacizumab and olaparib was approved for women, again, who had responded to frontline chemotherapy and who were considered HRD positive or genomically unstable by the Myriad MyChoice CDX. And so those were the two approvals that just came through. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the options that are available. I'm going to, a couple of you, and I think with Rob, I was trying to draw the analogy between your situation and ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. Call me crazy, but we'll get into that in a minute. Before you get into my whole theory of numeracy and trying to figure out what you all are actually doing and what the basis of it is so we can develop education programs. But Katie, let's talk about a case first before we start getting into these algorithms. And you have this 53-year-old woman. Can you talk about what happened to her?
Sure. So this is a 53-year-old presented in a very typical way with abdominal bloating and some changes in her bowel and bladder habits. She was seen by outside providers who gave her laxatives and other things that didn't help her, and finally presented to an OB-GYN who did a pelvic exam and appreciated a large mass and then did a transvaginal ultrasound with a big complex mass and ascites, and drew a CA125, which was markedly elevated. And so she was sent to see us, where we ordered a CT. So you can see some free fluid, omental caking on the left-hand side, and then this very complex, not friendly looking mass in the pelvis. So she underwent surgery, primary surgery. She was a young and healthy person. Found to have high-grade serous ovarian cancer. Like Dr. Liu, we sent both somatic and germline testing. So she was germline BRCA wild type, but she did have some interesting, kind of a typical next-gen sequencing panel, with the exception of the BRAF, which is a little weird in a high-grade serous. And then she had also the Myriad test sent, which showed an LOH score greater than 16. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is a foundation test, LOH score greater than 16. So a different test than Myriad.
So, Rob, what would you be thinking at this point before we hear what actually happened?
So she's, you know, we would classify this as a HR deficient, you know, situation with her LOH score being greater than 16% on foundation medicine.
So, and, how do you think you? What do you think you likely would do? Would you give her a PARP inhibitor, and if so, which one? Would you give her Bev?
So, with that knowledge ahead of time, I would consider her for a PARP inhibitor.
Which one?
I think you know if you're sticking with the label, niraparib would be the one that would be approved unless we had started Bev. And then she would be eligible. Well, she wouldn't technically be eligible, but I would probably still advocate for the use of olaparib.
So, Katie, what actually happened?
So she didn't have really bulky disease, and so didn't meet sort of high risk features. And I didn't elect to put her on bevacizumab post-op. And she's BRCA wild type, and so went into complete response following every 21-day paclitaxel carboplatin, and we used niraparib. Mm-hmm.
What was her platelet count, her weight, and what dose of niraparib do you use?
We would base her starting dose based on baseline weight, which is greater than or less than 77 kilograms, or baseline platelets greater than or less than 150,000. So if either of those are present, low weight, low platelets, we'd start her at 200 milligrams a day. If neither is present, I would start her. And honestly, if she had no problems with chemo, I would start her at 300. I do think there's clinical judgment that goes into these things. So
definitely,
you know,
and we'll, Katie, I was going to say, Neil, one thing to add here is, and this is where we'll come up, talk about this when we get to the veliparib, but is when you start. So how much break do you give between chemo and starting your niraparib?
I wait at least 6 weeks. So I see them for that 3 week visit post cycle six and talk about PARP inhibitor options at that point. And I do a lot of counseling and then I tell them we don't need to start anything for at least 3 weeks. And then I see them back again and we get the authorization and they usually start maybe 7 or 8 weeks, just depends on when they get the PARP. So I try to have them on by 8 weeks, but I don't start like cycle seven.
Right away. Yeah,
that's exactly. A great question. Yeah. Next time we do one of these 25 people poll, we can even ask that. So how long has she been on treatment and how is she tolerating it?
She's tolerating it well. She hasn't been on very long. So fortunately, you know, the NCCN guidelines came out before the FDA approval. So so we just slid right in there. And so she's only been on, those came out in January. So she's only been on about 3 months. And it's actually doing quite well. You know, the first 2 months of PARP are the worst for patients. And I just flat out tell them that because you're going to have nausea very rapidly. And then you have to individualize the dosing by cycle three. So she's through that now. We have her on the right dose and hopefully we'll be kind of smooth sailing from here. But I find the first few months you have to do some intervention sometimes.
I just have a question for Katie, like for niraparib, are you doing the CBC weekly?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm very, if you ask any of my partners, I'm sort of a little rabid about that.
Dogmatic. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
You know, it kind of makes me crazy here because they, I have so much help here, but they do it on all the PARPs. So like all the PARPs are getting labs now. And I'm like, you don't have to do it for olaparib, but I actually don't care because I'd rather overtest there than miss niraparib. 100% weekly until we're solid on the counts. And then I relax it to every 3 weeks. Well, and I do that for a few months, but I don't let them go too long.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the next case and maybe Stephanie, you can react to it. I'll just interject here. One of the other questions that came in was what about the status of using PARP inhibitors in other cancers? And just to pump back, we're actually doing a satellite to the AACR meeting on June 23rd. We'll send all the attendees a notification, but we're talking about breast, ovary, pancreas, and prostate.
There you go.
All four of them in that same meeting on the 23rd. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who are interested, and it's really great when you get everybody together and they start comparing notes about toxicity. It's super interesting.
That was fascinating last year. I learned so we did about pancreas last year. It was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, Katie was part of that.
Even talking about HRD between the difference between the different types, the definition of HRD is so conflictual between the
Exactly. Anyhow, it's different.
Well, you know, the prostate people are saying it should be called PRCA and not BRCA because prostate is so BRCA-like. But anyhow, Katie, what about this 63-year-old lady? She had a lot of disease there when she presented.
Yeah, so this is a little different situation. She's a little bit older, underwent surgery, unfortunately, on the outside and had really extensive disease and so got to us with a lot of disease and an incision on her belly and a pleural effusion. So, you know, we had to get her just going on therapy. So she was high-grade endometrioid on pathology review at our site, and you can see her next-gen sequencing panel that we sent. I don't know why I picked two people with BRAF, but here you go.
That's so weird.
It's so weird. I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't have a point.
Incidentally, are those V600E BRAFs?
No.
Oh, okay. No. Okay.
Yes. All right. Well, anyhow. I don't know that they're actionable, to be honest. Yeah.
Right.
LOH here was less than 16%, but an ARID1 mutation, which is somewhat interesting as well.
Yeah.
So she got paclitaxel carboplatin every 21 days with bevacizumab here. Because of her stage 4A status, she responded with her CA125, but not great. You know, still elevated at 400, had a partial response at the end of six cycles. And she really did not tolerate the bevacizumab well, having to come off with very, very high blood pressures despite aggressive management. But I'd already planned on using the Paola regimen when I stopped the bevacizumab, so I'd already gotten it authorized again because the NCCN guidelines came out in January. And so I just rolled with the olaparib. That's what I did.
So this relates to the Bev hypertension. Did you dose reduce her?
With the Bev?
Yeah.
We did it because
I've done that.
Have you done that? Does it work?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, you know that you know you have a broad therapeutic window there. It does work, actually.
So cool.
Anyhow, I think that's a good introduction to the question of the day. And in fact, we could probably spend the next couple hours or more talking about it. But my goal is at least to try to figure out what the four of you are doing. We have cases like this one. This is a scenario. We have a younger patient, BRCA germline. Talk about the fact that this patient also had optimal debulking, normal CA125. So, Rob, the question is, what do you do with a patient like that? And it looks like the most common answer in the investigators is simply solo one. But interestingly, there are a bunch of people, even with optimal debulking, who would try to bring in Paola. So, Rob, yeah. What are your thoughts about this case?
Yeah, I think I answered this at the top line, following solo one. You know, if you look at the, and we might be able to talk about this later, but we actually, they try to get patient level data to look at the difference between the PALA one data and solo one data for the BRCA patients, this exact analysis. And there is a slight benefit to it. And I shouldn't say that's too strong. There is the curves are slightly separated. They're not obviously going to be measurable to be different. And I think with the added, effect on patients, taking Bev during chemo and then Bev after chemo for the duration, it does make it a slightly more problematic regimen. I think I chose for at least for the answer because of the optimal patient population that just the solo one data.
You actually answered the second one, incidentally, but that's okay. No. Really leads into the question that Rob and I were debating. The reason he sent me these two papers, and let me go to you, Joyce. The question I had for Rob is, because one of the things you hear from docs in practice is, okay, it's fine to see all these evidence-based data. But when you have a woman who comes in who's got three small kids and says, I want everything, every day, everything you do, does that kind of change your approach? And the question I had for him, Joyce, was even in the lower risk, which is not that low, it looks like to me, but even in the lower risk situation of optimal debulking, do you think there's a benefit of giving Bev, Joyce?
So I think you asked me that as well, and I said no. I said it's not going to help women live longer based upon everything we know. But I did want to say that I answered this question differently, and I said other, because I would give this woman IPIV chemo.
No, I know. That was the next thing I was going to ask you.
Just to open up that other door, I would give this woman IPIV.
I saw it right there. You're the only one out of the 25 who gave that answer, but I'm sure we could have found a couple other people. Just out of curiosity, I'm guessing you're not doing that right this moment?
We're not able to do this right this moment, but for especially because she's got a BRCA mutation. I mean, the data for IPIV in BRCA mutation, granted, they're not randomized trials. Some of the women with BRCA mutations have really profound responses with IP chemo, which totally makes sense.
Which is interesting, right?
You have a really platinum-sensitive tumor, and you're giving really high doses of platinum. Like, I think if you're going to choose something that's going to help somebody's survival, IPIV is what I would choose over Bev.
So, Stephanie, the patient comes to you for a second opinion and says, Dr. Arlou suggesting IPIV therapy. You think that's a good idea?
I will not go to the high PEC discussion either. because there's a lot of discussion regarding high PEC as well, because specifically for the patient who has this homologous repair deficiency, the high dose maybe of platinum, but maybe the heat as well. And we don't know how the heat may also impact. But in terms of the specific question regarding bevacizumab, I think I agree. If a patient is BRCA mutated with a complete debulking surgery and going to the R0, really, as we say, I think I will go with the solo one data because like this plateau that we have seen with olaparib maintenance treatment, I think it's probably the choice that I will advise as well.
So, Katie, I want you to take the next scenario. Before we get off this one, though, I want you to comment on the fact that there are only a couple people, investigators, who said niraparib from BRCA germline. And a lot of times when you ask people, they'll say, you know, it really is an equivalent choice. I'm just more used to using it. I've been used. Is there any sort of scientific basis to choose between the two in this situation of BRCA germline, Katie?
I really don't think so in the setting of BRCA germline. I think that you should use the PARP that you're most comfortable managing for your patient. There's people that are very comfortable with niraparib because they've been involved in a lot of the clinical trials, and there's people that have just been using olaparib. So for that population, I can't think of a or a pharmacokinetic reason why one would be superior to another.
So let's go on to the next scenario. So BRCA germline, Katie, now much higher risk because of suboptimal debulking, elevated CA125. And it looks like it's very interesting in terms of the investigators. There's a real movement now with this higher risk towards Bev. But it's interesting, there's six people who use just the Bev during chemotherapy and don't continue with olaparib. So Katie, how do you think this one through?
Well, I don't think anyone is wrong, to be perfectly honest.
Right.
So I am, as long as you're using a PARP, you're wrong if you're not using a PARP, but otherwise you're okay. So the SOLO-1 study did not allow prior bevacizumab. And so when a provider would think that bevacizumab appropriately was the right choice for their patient, and then they would discover through the cycles of 1 through 6 that they had a BRCA mutation, either germline or somatic, they were faced with this decision to stop, which isn't how bevacizumab was approved. The benefit is with and to follow. So you're kind of truncating your benefit of bevacizumab, but the benefit of olaparib is so much higher, they would stop, which I don't think is wrong. You know, if someone wants to stop and get rid of the toxicity of bevacizumab in a patient who has responded very well, I think that that's completely appropriate. The nice thing about Paola is that it gives you the option to continue and just layer on the olaparib. So in a patient that still has a partial response, or just because, you know, you want to use bevacizumab because that's what you're comfortable with, now you can add on olaparib for the same amount of time as SOLO-1. And in that study in BRCA-associated cancers, the magnitude of benefit was, you know, 0.67. I mean, it was 67% reduction in the hazard of risk of progression or death. Huge. So, I think you can individualize to your patient now. Whereas before you were kind of driven by how the study was designed, which was necessary for the era, but didn't really reflect practice necessarily.
So here's the way the docs in practice answered very similarly. And also there's a cohort. Also, we saw this in the past. I can remember seeing this where people use Bev only during the chemotherapy, even before Paola came out. But, you know, kind of generally similar to what investigators are doing. So we also want to get into the issue of sort of the other end of the spectrum in terms of patients, both optimal and suboptimal debulking, but those who have other genomic profiles. So we asked Stephanie about patients with somatic BRCA. So in this situation, it was suboptimal debulking like we just talked about, and you really kind of see the same approach to treatment with the somatic BRCA as you do with germline BRCA. Again, Stephanie, is that your practice in general, somatic BRCA? You approach them the exact same way?
Yeah. Yeah, I think for the somatic BRCA, yes, I approach the same way. And as Katie just said, like when we talk about maintenance treatment, I think it's very important because there's a continuous maintenance for bevacizumab, which is we start with chemo and then we maintain, and which is very different for the PARP inhibitor treatment. It's a switch maintenance, so it's a very different approach. So if we think that a patient needs bevacizumab, I think it's reasonable to, and in this specific case with a somatic BRCA mutation and suboptimal, to have starting bevacizumab, and then as we discussed, to you know adapt according to each patient, and definitely for a somatic BRCA mutation, having a PARP maintenance treatment is definitely appropriate and needed.
Joyce, I saw a question come in the chat room about false negative HRD. Can you comment on that, Joyce?
Well, so I think that goes back to the idea that the HRD tests are a imperfect proxy, or Rob's smoke and fire sort of analogy. And so you can definitely have tests, you can definitely have tumors that test as being HR deficient that are not actually in reality HR deficient. They are perfectly HR proficient. Uh-huh. So do you want me to
and the other way around too,
or just the false negatives?
Well, let's
and the other way around too.
This next one is the real one I want to hear about. So if you decide that you're going to measure HRD and it's negative and they're BRCA wild type, now we're saying optimal debulking surgery. The question is, what are you going to do? And wow, this is a pretty interesting spectrum that you see among the investigators, from not using a PARP inhibitor to using niraparib to using Bev without a PARP inhibitor. Rob, again, think about yourself seeing second opinions, where the first opinion might be either one of these first three choices. First of all, what your likely choice, Rob, and what do you think about the other choices?
So, yeah, I think I chose Bev on this one. I hope I did. I think they're all could be used. I think many people that are not, there are many people that believe that Bev only works well enough to be used in suboptimal patients. And I'm not one of those, but some people do, and that's fine. And so these patients, all stage three, regardless if they're optimal or suboptimal, they're high risk for recurrence, regardless. And so at that patient population, in my experience, I would use Bev as a way to mitigate that risk for recurrence. But it's I can't argue with any of them. Certainly, niraparib is approved now. But it's that's how I would choose it. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's interesting that a lot of people don't order HRD, and yet if you give them the result, they change what they do. It reminds me, when we do breast cancer with the surgeons, you say, would you use a genomic assay neoadjuvantly? They say no, and then we say, well, suppose somebody else did it and it was positive, and then they changed their therapy.
Right.
So it is kind of interesting about that observation. We go to the next one, we see the same situation, HRD negative, now suboptimal debulking. Now you see almost everybody using Bev.
Yeah.
But it still is not pushing. It pushes a few people into using a PARP inhibitor, but not too many. Mm-hmm. This is HRD positive. And I would just say in general, just like I was saying about the somatic, that in general, it looks like the answers are similar. So if you do the assay, it looks like people are kind of paying attention to it. Although
so,
it's interesting.
Hey, Neil,
yeah, I was just going to question about the Bev.
Yeah, so the only question I have with this one, there's this came up before too, is that there some people are using paclitaxel carboplatin and Bev followed by niraparib. So they're stopping the Bev and giving niraparib. And I think that the point of this, and this is an optimal patient, so I'm not really sure exactly this patient. I can see it in the suboptimal. But we know in 218, we showed that there was no benefit to giving it during chemotherapy if you did not continue it as maintenance. So I'm not quite sure about this. But I think that if you talked about a suboptimal patient, somebody may say, listen, I want to give them the best chance to have a response, and then I'm going to put them on a PARP. And that may be why you're seeing some of those choices. But that came up before. I saw in one of your previous slides.
That is interesting. I guess another question we had, if we can go to the next slide, we were talking before, and pretty much everybody now is using the same criteria that we were just talking about in terms of of dosing. Stephanie, any other comments about how you're approaching and making this decision about PARP or not, which PARP, and Bev or not.
Yeah, so I think the, as I say, and it's why Rob said that the bevacizumab was continuous maintenance. It's why I really emphasize the fact that it was a continuous data what we have for bevacizumab. In terms of, I think what is very different with the PARP inhibitor treatment, I think it's great for patients because it's a pills. But because it's a pills, we rely a lot on the patient taking it at home. And I think an important piece that we need to take into consideration is the education that we need to have to the patient and the expectation as well that we hope for the for this kind of treatment. And I think talking about the toxicity, what the practicality of using the PARP inhibitor treatment, I think all of this context should definitely be explained to the patient because globally, and as we can see in terms of PARP inhibitor treatment, we often say that it's well tolerated because it's true, it's mainly grade 1 and 2. But as we say, it's a continuum, it's a switch maintenance for at least 2 years for laparib or 3 years for niraparib. So it's a long chronic treatment to take. And the grade 1 and 2 can be quite significant for a patient in a long term and for the quality of life. So I think it's another important thing to discuss with a patient when we introduce this treatment.
And of course, financial toxicity is another issue. Stephanie, you had a, you know, you mentioned this concept of switch and continuation maintenance, which I think, I don't know, people who treat lung cancer remember those terms from about 5 years ago is when I first started hearing them. You had a slide in your deck that I thought was really cool, trying to explain what the difference is. It's sort of simple, but yet the more you think about it, the more it kind of means. Can you kind of go through, Stephanie, what this is?
Yeah, so I think for me, I point this slide because I think it's very important, specifically what we want to analyze the study altogether. I think it's very important concept that we need to have, and specifically for the bevacizumab, but also for the PARP inhibitor treatment. So for example, if we take the veraparib trial, veraparib was given with chemo, and then again, this continuous maintenance. So we don't have a gap or a break. And again, when we're talking about olaparib or niraparib, or recalcitrant at the time of platinum-sensitive recurrence, we have a gap. So patient actually had the chemotherapy, had to respond to the chemotherapy because all these trials did not include stable disease. Like as part of this trial, patient had to have a partial response or complete response. So again, we can discuss what we do in practice sometimes, but like all this trial was this kind of 8 weeks gap usually before the end of the chemo and starting the PARP inhibitor treatment. So when we analyze, for example, the continuous maintenance or the switch maintenance, the timing will be different because we didn't start the maintenance at the same time. So I think that is an important notion when we look at the data.
So before we go on, I wanted to talk a little bit about practical issues, particularly toxicity. Just one final thought, getting back, Rob, to our discussion and you sending me these papers and my simplified, you know, approach to this. The one thing that I think I'm hearing you all say is this issue of Bev and PARP inhibitor, the reason it reminds me of chemotherapy, endocrine therapy, and breast cancer is it sounds like it's a separate decision. You know, each one it affects is. Each other. Each affects the numbers. So if you bring the number down, the absolute benefit change. But in terms of relative risk reduction, it seems like they're kind of two separate decisions. And it sounds like what you all are doing is applying one risk reduction to Bev, although some of you believe it doesn't really thunder out there. Probably the whole thing will go down here with any event. So maybe you question whether it's there or not, but it certainly doesn't change. But yet when you look at the PARP decision, there what I see in a basic, you know, adjuvant type module is the risk reduction changes. So if you have BRCA germline, you get a big risk, much bigger risk reduction, and you know, going down to HRD, et cetera. So it kind of reminded me that of that, Rob, in that they're kind of independent numeric functions that you can sort of work with. Does that kind of make sense to you?
Yeah, see? Congratulations. You did good.
I understand your papers. Is that what your paper said?
You got it. And it's funny that you bring it up because actually there's a question that came in through the chat room that asked about this indirectly. They basically said, hey, listen, if I get 3 months in the median for Bev and 3 months in the median for NRAPRIV, why, you know, why do you choose it? And so I answered it back and I said, listen, the point is, and this is what you just illustrated, is that hazard ratios reflect the risk at every single point of exposure. So from day one until the end of the time that they're exposed to the drug, there is a risk reduction that happens. And that's not captured well by using medians. So yes, if you see a 30% reduction in the 30% reduction in the hazard for progression or death, that's what you're looking at with BEV. That's what you're looking at with these PARP inhibitors. And it's even greater in the patient population that's defined by the biomarker.
Yeah, it kind of frustrates me when I hear people talk about absolute differences because, theoretically, you're really looking at hazard rate. And actually, correct me if I'm wrong, the hazard rates in the advanced disease of platinum-sensitive trials seem similar hazard rate-wise to what you saw in adjuvant, like 70% reduction bracket germline, in the niraparib study. Anyhow, let's talk a little bit again in terms of practical decision-making. We have a couple of cases we want to talk about in terms of tolerability. So Joyce, you had this patient, interestingly, with a RAD51C germline mutation, a 74-year-old woman. Can you talk about what happened to her?
Yeah, so this was her first platinum-sensitive recurrence. She actually had a strong family history of ovarian cancer. Her RAD51C was called a VUS, but given her history, I considered it probably more likely to be deleterious than not. She got carboplatin and liposomal doxorubicin, had a complete response. I put her on maintenance olaparib at the full dose. And about 4 weeks after starting, she just really wasn't sort of keeping up. She had more fatigue. She actually had diarrhea. Her platelet count went down to 99,000. And so given all of the constellation of symptoms, we held her drug. We started olaparib at 250 2 weeks later. Her platelets, held totally fine. But after about 4 weeks, she just was like, I can't function. I just can't keep going. And so we held her. We put her back on olaparib 200 milligrams twice a day 2 weeks after that, after she'd recovered her energy. And she's still on maintenance olaparib. She gets a little bit tired, but it's more of a grade one type fatigue. She gets tired around 4 or 5 p.m., but she's otherwise able to do stuff.
So Katie, that also gets into the issue of the relationship between dose and toxicity with PARP inhibitors. I'm curious whether this story that Joyce just told is one that you see in your own practice, that you can adjust the dose and have patients tolerate it better.
Absolutely. That's where we talked a little bit about sort of the pre-counseling, reasons to call me, a lot of people don't have I'm really blessed. I have a lot of nursing support, but a lot of people don't have that. But having your nursing support or your whoever answers the phone calls kind of keyed into those key issues. And then using dose interruptions really judiciously, especially for non-hematologic toxicities, patients with sort of grade 2 fatigue, which is really bothersome, or nausea, you can just do a dose interruption for 3 to 5 days. They feel better. You can try and initiate at the starting dose, and if they do, sometimes that's all you need and they do great. Or if it recurs, then you can bring them down a little bit. And the various PARPs have different dose, the number of dose levels varies by the different PARPs. Like niraparib has 3, rucaparib has 5, and olaparib has 4. Did I just make that up, Joyce? 350, 200, 150.
I think olaparib, technically, I think the tablets haven't gone to 150 in the trials.
But they have the 50s. Yeah, sweet. Hundreds of 50s. Yeah.
But I would Pepper say that, the most. That being said, yeah. A patient who isn't tolerating, I would probably go down to 150 BID, even though there's no trial.
I want to get to Stephanie's case. So before we do, Joyce, a couple questions from the audience. Someone in the audience has an 18-year-old woman with stage 3C serous papillary ovarian cancer.
Oh my God.
Any difference in your approach to an 18-year-old, Joyce?
Well, I mean, I think I worry a lot about what is, whether or not she has a genetic predisposition, but it doesn't change sort of my general approach in terms of treatment options and approach towards therapy. No.
I would be very sure that there was good pathology review on that. Sometimes it's very hard to tell low-grade serous from high-grade serous in places where they don't see a lot of
juvenile granulosa cell. I would look for a misdiagnosis.
That would be my first thing.
Misdiagnosis.
Path
so what, best chance for a cure.
Yeah. Rob, what do you think would be a more likely diagnosis or a possible other diagnosis, Rob?
Oh, so yeah, the ones that are more common. So it's just as Katie said. So we check for low grade, make sure that's there. And also for other tumor types like a germ cell tumor or a stromal cell tumor, like juvenile granulocell tumor.
Although so I will say that although it's uncommon, it is not impossible for an 18-year-old.
Right. It's not impossible. Right. Yeah.
I have certainly seen that.
Definitely seen young. Yeah.
So Stephanie, you had a case of a patient who had problems on olaparib and you actually chose to switch. So can you talk a little bit, curious whether the other faculties ever tried that and what they see? What happened with your case, Stephanie?
Yeah, so it's a patient that was high-grade serous ovarian cancer, platinum-sensitive recurrence, has responding to the sixth cycle of carboplatin paclitaxel, and then was starting on olaparib maintenance. Usually I give some preventive medication for nausea. And despite the preventive medication for nausea, she still has a nausea. I ask the patient eventually to take a little snack as well with a tablet that sometimes can help. And patients are different in terms of what they want to take as a snack. But despite despite some drug holidays or dose reduction, the nausea was really impacting her life. Unfortunately, she was not keen to continue given all this nausea. But given the benefit of the PARP maintenance in the context of a BRCA mutation, we were a little bit concerned not to have a kind of maintenance in that situation. So there is no specific guidelines, there is no specific recommendation, or there is no specific trial assessing that. But we know that there's a class effect in terms of toxicity for the different PARP inhibitor treatment, but there's some slight difference between the PARP inhibitor treatment. We try to switch her to niraparib to see if she will have maybe less nausea and maybe more tolerable. So it's just early days for her, I think, I don't know if other of the faculty have any experience about switching to see if that helped the patient or not.
So Neil, I was going to send you another paper, but it was in Science, and I thought I'd spare you. But there is a recent paper that just came out that talks about PARPs into three different classes that may be related to this, and so you can throw niraparib and rucaparib in one kind of class, and then you can put the olaparib and tala in a different class, and veliparib in a third class. And these are different. What they differ by are what they call the allosteric interaction on the PARP molecule, and so they have different effects on this allosteric interaction. And so, if you're going to change classes, rather than going from, for instance, from like something in the same class, I would change classes just as Steph did, and go to something like a olaparib or to a niraparib, to change the classes just because they have a differential rate on the amount of allosteric interaction and their potential for this toxicity that might be related to PARP trapping.
But there's still something to like toxicities. So I think that's true, and that's an amazing paper. But we just had the scenario where I was staffing our fellows clinic. My fellow is super bright about PARP inhibitors. I'm very proud of her. But she had a patient on niraparib, and she's like, my patient has terrible insomnia. It's the thing that bothers her the most, and she can't sleep.
See?
And I've dose reduced her, and she's just miserable and wants to quit. Yep. You say that insomnia is really common with the PARP inhibitors, which it is. So I don't know that I can keep her on a PARP. But the key thing with this particular patient, we went down, kind of looked at everything, was she also had palpitations, and she also had hypertension. So she's got hypertension, she's got palpitations, and she's got insomnia. So it's that dopaminergic certain
pathway
that's very specific to niraparib.
Yep.
Does not exist with olaparib and rucaparib. So in that scenario, it would make sense to switch, not on that allosteric class. So. Yes. You know, I think you have to think about it as we understand more. I think in the early days, we're like, switching doesn't make sense.
Right.
Which now it's like, oh yeah, but from this to this, this depends on why.
Stephanie, you wrote a great paper on toxicity. And one of the issues is how much difference there really is. Katie was just talking a little bit about that. But in terms of class effects, Would you say, Stephanie, you see some kind of cytopenias with all PARP inhibitors, some kind of GI? It just kind of it varies based on the drug and the individual. Is that your take?
Yeah, I think the hematological toxicity are common across all the PARP inhibitor treatment. I think there is some slight difference between the different PARP, but as we discussed earlier, definitely hematological toxicity seems to be a little bit more for niraparib, specifically for the platelets. So it's why the weekly CBC is important when we start niraparib, which is not the case for the other PARP, where every 2 weeks at the beginning should be sufficient because you don't have this thrombocytopenia as much as the as seen in the niraparib. But hematological toxicity remain across the different PARP. So it's why I think having regular CBC remain very important during all the treatment. At short term is really to look at the cytopenia. In long term is also to track eventually some MDS. MDS is rare, but can happen. So I think this blood check I think is very important. In terms of the GI toxicity, again, it's seen in different PARP inhibitor treatment. Olaparib and rucaparib are relatively similar in terms of GI. Niraparib seems to be a little bit less in terms of the GI, but have other potential other effects, as we just discussed, at the hypertension as well.
I was just thinking last year, I remember when we were at the meeting, you were like, oh, it's going to be great coming to Toronto next year. We never made it, did we?
We never
quite made it. Anyhow, Rob, I don't know if we're going to get to your case. You have a case of a patient who
great
got
rucaparib.
But I want to just ask you to respond to this question we asked. I don't know if we'll get to your case, but if you can just talk a little bit, because we asked the faculty about the situation, the one situation you see with rucaparib that, you know, is kind of unique, I think. Or maybe it's not completely unique, but at least
it's not
been described. So we presented a patient who starts rucaparib and then her creatinine starts to go up. Mm-hmm. We asked people what they would do, and they're kind of split. Most people would keep the rucaparib going, and I'm sure people would do maybe some type of workup. But Rob, in general, how do you approach patients who have creatinines going up on rucaparib?
Yeah, generally I do like treat like any other emergent toxicity because you don't know if this is real or not. It's definitely found in this. We described it pretty well in the Aerial 2 and Aerial 3 studies, but I typically will hold it. It comes down very rapidly and then restart the same dose. If it goes back up again, I'll rehold it and then I'll check to make sure that I'm not just treating essentially a creatinemia and not a renal dysfunction, because that's really what you're trying to go after. In the case that we're not going to talk about, what happened with that one, she was actually an Aerial 2 patient, and we did exactly that. Of course, we were following the protocol, so we did the delay dose modification, but she went on to get almost 2 years of drug with a benefit, and then ultimately did develop acute kidney injury that led us to take her off of study. But we used a GFR scan to actually demonstrate that she actually had normal GFR, but had elevated creatinine due to the interaction with the transporters.
So you think it was the rucaparib causing renal damage?
Not damage, not at first.
Or dysfunction.
Dysfunction, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but normally what it does is it just interferes with the mate and transporters, and so you see this accumulation of creatinine, but you don't actually see kidney injury. And of course, that's what we check for, right? Is to estimate what their GFR is, and obviously it'll be increasing, and showing that their GFR is decreasing, and so we're worried about that. But what we showed in this patient was that her GFR was above 90 or above 89, I think, and it stayed that way. So we intermittently checked it, made sure. So it was just an elevated creatinine that didn't actually associate with kidney injury.
So, Joyce, last year as I was walking around, I was stumbling around, lack of sleep from the long trip to Hawaii, I was reading Rob's paper on toxicity, and he brought up the impact of PARP on circadian rhythm. And I started to ask people, do you see insomnia? And people started to say yes. And incidentally, when I asked the other people, like the breast people, prostate, nobody, I don't know if they're not asking about insomnia or, it doesn't occur. Mm-hmm. But I'm just kind of curious, Joyce, clinically, have you seen insomnia? Do you think these drugs cause insomnia?
Yeah, you can see insomnia in some patients. I think that, you know, Katie was bringing it up, certainly with niraparib, with the dopaminergic effects, but definitely you can see insomnia with some patients. I think, you know, it's hard to tease it out with all of the other psychosocial stressors that come along with a diagnosis of cancer, but I personally think that we see it.
So I want to move on now and talk about another issue, and actually Rob has a couple of cases that'll help us get into it. It's really amazing how the ESMO meeting the last 2 years has really been so consequential in terms of this area. Of course, we saw SOTA 1 year before, and this year we saw the Paola study, the niraparib study. But the other study was Rob's study, the VILIA study, which is the only one that used the PARP during a chemotherapy, specifically veliparib. And Rob, you have this 60-year-old lady. What happened with her?
Well, this is actually the patient.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is your recaprib case. This is your recaprib case. So, yeah. And you already went through it, but yeah. I guess.
Yeah, there's the real
great case.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there it was.
Okay. Here we go. Billy. So okay. 56 year old.
Yeah. So 56 year old. She had high grade serous. She, we knew she was germline BRCA wild type. She had pretty heavy disease in the omentum and diaphragm and grossly enlarged pelvic nodes and had big mass, big CA125. And she went into the study. Which was had three arms. One was placebo throughout with chemo. One was veliparib with chemo and followed by placebo, and then a veliparib throughout our arm.
How did she do on therapy?
So we started on dose dance, and she you can see the doses there, and it's important to note that the chemotherapy here is essentially full dose chemotherapy, which we would give to a patient without veliparib. And she had a tremendous response. So you can see her CA125 went from like 6,700 down to 72. And she had almost complete resolution of her omental and diaphragm disease. Her nodes returned to almost normal size and became kind of equivocal. And the ovaries were markedly smaller too. So of course she was on the study, had responded, went on to onto the maintenance phase of the trial. But what was interesting is that when we got her somatic testing back, she had a RAD51D mutation, which makes sense for why she had such a dramatic response.
What is your take on the side effects profile of veliparib? You all have been talking about the other three drugs, but what about veliparib? Where do you put it in terms of GI problems? Where do you put it in terms of cytopenia?
So if, from the standpoint of how you look at the PARP inhibitors across the board, and our best indication of that was to look at it in the maintenance phase, and we reported that in the study. And so if you look at from cycle 7 through the termination of the trial, they're very similar in terms of frequency. They have the same kind of GI side effects, a few hemologic, but most of the side effects are very, are grade 1-2. The difference in the chemotherapy phase reflects that there is a slightly increased risk of hemologic toxicity that you would see if you were giving other chemo combinations with PARP. But there's never been a study that has been able to use full dose chemotherapy with a PARP other than veliparib.
So I'm going to ask Katie the same question, but first I want to ask you, Rob, which is if this strategy, this drug were approved, can you describe a situation where you might prefer it? And can you describe how you would place it along, putting aside sort of FDA indication issues, how, if at all, would you use it practically outside a trial setting right now?
So, I think that the data are very strong in the BRCA population and in the HRD population, which includes the BRCA patients. I think the question comes up is what does it look like in the patients that, the all-comer populations that are not defined by that. And we didn't, we provided data on that analysis, but obviously it's a subgroup that's not really well characterized. So personally, it gets back to, you said there were two decisions, right?
Yes.
And that's the key. So if you're a believer in Bev, you're going to start that at that point with the chemotherapy. If you're a believer in PARP and you have this available to you and you think it's of value, you'll start it then. And so you have defined the course after that point in time. So if I'm, and I think in a BRCA HRD patient, I would probably start, I think I would give serious consideration to putting them on veliparib.
So Katie, agree or disagree?
You know, I think this is one where, I don't know what I said, but I changed my mind almost every based on Velia. I was definitely not hypothesis tested, but I was really struck by the data that Dave O'Malley presented at SGO with improved response rates, especially amongst the homologous recombination proficient patients. And so I would like to see the only that group pulled out and see the PFS curves for those that got veliparib followed by placebo versus nothing. Because I want to see that group. I'm interested in that group because that's the group we're failing right now.
Yeah.
In addition to the patients, and someone on the question and answer, which I've been trying to answer some of them, asked this question, you know, basically, what do you do with someone who has stable disease? And none of Prima, Paola, Solo do not answer that question. Velia, while not again hypothesis tested, did include those patients. And so get some data on them that they, it looks like they do benefit some. And so I'd like to see, I bet it's coming, some more of that breakout, just hypothesis generating, but it may be the best data we have.
Right.
So I'm undecided, Neil. I struggle with the excess toxicity during chemo. But I don't want to leave women behind, which I think the HRD assay does. And so that's why I have concerns about it. And so if this makes me able to not leave women behind who will benefit, then I might be sold on it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the, go ahead, Rob.
I was going to say, you know, the other issue is that a lot of people look at these curves and they start looking at the numbers and doing the cross trial comparisons. But I think it's important that people remember that this decision, that the Velia data represent the decision of all patients who have not been exposed to treatment to get this triplet versus placebo. And so patients that did not respond, you know, during their induction chemotherapy were not eligible for any of the other maintenance trials other than the patients who didn't have, you know, measurable disease. So what Katie said is important, just like it was with Bev, to make sure that we remember that we are treating an all-comer population and we do not know what the future of that person is when they're sitting in your clinic on cycle one. So you need to make a decision on cycle one.
So I was just thinking as I hear this violent thunderstorm outside. So if you lose me, the four of you, just keep going. You have another 15 minutes. Good luck. But anyhow, you know, kind of as you talk, I keep wanting to go back to module two and we you know, we try to move forward because there is no end to this discussion. It's like the Talmud. And in fact, we built in breakout sessions that we're doing with all of our faculty, including all four of you. We're doing another conference after all this is over that we're going to tell you about, a series of four teleconferences. We're going to go through both PARP and immune with one person from each faculty just to keep talking about it. We have hundreds of great questions coming in. We're going to curate them and go through those and try to bring some of that up. But this is a deep, a complicated story that, you know, you can't tell in 90 minutes, but I did want to bring in just briefly issues related to recurrent disease, sort of revisit this, Stephanie. This used to be all we had to talk about, although it was really interesting to talk about. And of course, once all these other trials came in, we haven't talked about it as much. But just to sort of put our finger on the pulse, so to speak, of how people are currently, now that the data has had a little while to shake out, how they're approaching platinum sensitive recurrence. And looks like in a patient with a germline mutation who's never had a PARP inhibitor. And I guess, Stephanie, the only thing to note here is just, you know, it is interesting, the breakout in terms of which PARP. It kind of reminds me a little bit with the CDK inhibitors in breast cancer. You have three, but palbociclib was the first one that was approved and people still use that, although the three seem to be very, very similar. Any comments, Stephanie, about how you choose a PARP inhibitor in the platinum-sensitive situation?
So that is a good question. I think In terms of efficacy, activity, I think these three PARP inhibitors are probably similar in terms of activity. So I think it's potentially the profile of the side effect that can be taken into account. Also, the fact that one PARP is only once a day and the other one are BID, so that can be also something to discuss with the patient as well. We're waiting the overall survival data for the rucaparib and niraparib, but we recently at the abstract, so we're waiting the full data for the presentation, but we have recently the overall survival update from SOLO2 for the patient who mm-hmm. are BRCA mutation, and it's an impressive, unprecedented, I would say, benefit of overall survival in this population. So I think that is important to take into account in the decision.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to seeing the survival data on these upfront trials because the hazard rates and recurrence are just spectacular. Never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
But Joyce, here's another situation in platinum sensitive recurrent. Joyce is a patient who has, you know, we said BRCA wild type, HRD negative in the platinum sensitive recurrent situation. You can see there's a whole spectrum of choices involving Bev and all the PARP inhibitors, Joyce. So I guess you can imagine somebody going to seven different doctors and getting seven different recommendations here, but where would you fit in on this spectrum, Joyce?
Well, so I think this is, you know, this comes back to philosophically sort of this balance. If you've got somebody with relapsed disease and this woman has relapsed disease, are you going to cure them by giving them more sort of therapy at this point? And then it becomes very much a balance of, you know, what is the value of a progression-free survival benefit versus not? This woman doesn't have a BRCA mutation, so I don't think we have, you know, we don't have a suggestion that PARP inhibitor maintenance in this setting. I'm sorry, I can't see it. This was HRD negative, I think also, that we don't see, you know, we don't have evidence that a PARP inhibitor or that Bev in this setting, outside of DOG-213 maybe, Rob, is going to give you an OS benefit. Then it really becomes a balance, you know, what is it worth to the patient to be on a pill? What is it worth to on a patient to be mm-hmm. on a maintenance sort of IV infusion that you have to keep coming in for indefinitely until you relapse versus what is it worth of them to basically be done and sort of move on? I think of the choices that were up there, the one that I really have some hesitance about is, you know, people who are giving, you know, chemo plus Bev followed plus Bev plus PARP. So I think we just don't have data that's, you know, going to really help patients and potentially is just going to contribute to a lot of financial toxicity.
Joyce, a couple other practical questions that came up. I think I might have gone over one, but a couple questions. One, PARP after PARP. Patient has a BRCA germline mutation. They've already gotten one PARP inhibitor, progressed. Would you try another one? What about rechallenge to the patient who had, you know, sort of adjuvant PARP inhibitor? So Joyce, PARP after PARP. And then can you also address the issue of stopping PARP and patients are going to have surgery?
Yeah, so I think PARP after PARP, you know, somebody who has progressed through a PARP, we don't have data right now that switching them to one of the other PARP inhibitors is going to overcome their mechanism of resistance, whatever that might have been. And so in general, I do not take somebody who has actively progressed on a PARP and put them on another PARP. A PARP combination, absolutely, I'm interested in exploring that in trials, but just to put them on another PARP, I think is not generally going to benefit them. It's a lot more complicated without data right now when you think about somebody who has progressed on adjuvant PARP, has finished adjuvant PARP in the frontline setting, relapses, goes back on platinum, has a BRCA mutation. Are they going to benefit from getting PARP inhibitor again? Because they've never progressed on the PARP. And I think we don't know that answer right now. That's what the Oreo trial hopefully will tell us. Right now my inclination is I err on the side of giving them a chance, although I will say that is practicing completely without data and is not sort of, you know, that's not supported so much as I'm trying to give my patients the chance that I can while I don't have data to support that.
Stephanie, very, very practical question. Stephanie, actually a couple of people asked about it. a patient's going to have surgery. People brought up the patients having prophylactic mastectomy, for example. How far in advance would you stop the PARPinter prior to surgery? If so, how long, Stephanie? When do you restart it? And is this mainly about cytopenias or also wound healing?
So the half-life is short for PARP inhibitor treatment. So that is very important. And again, it depends the type of surgery. So if it's really a minor surgery, I think stopping just one day before is probably sufficient. And then it depends on how the patient is doing post-op. But if the patient is well and don't have any problem of wound healing and everything, I think to resume 2-3 days post-op could be reasonable.
That's interesting. That's a lot quicker than I would have thought. And I think a lot of people answer. Joyce, how far in advance do you typically stop people before surgery?
So for, like Stephanie said, for something that's not a major surgery, I will stop probably 48 hours to 72 hours beforehand because the half-life is short. Now, if somebody has, residual cytopenias on the PARP inhibitor that they just sort of stay on, then I'll stop them a little bit sooner. And then post-surgically, I resume sort of depending upon how their healing is going.
Yeah.
And, right. So the last thing was...
Often have this question as well for the dental work. So I think for the dental work is definitely...
That's the most common.
It's the most common. So it's why my answer is really for the dental. So it's why maybe why you are surprised. But usually the most common question regarding the dental work. And that I think it's usually 2-3 days after the dental work is really fine usually.
Yeah, the question we asked actually in the survey was hip replacement. So that's a little bit more.
Yeah, that is different.
We have a couple minutes left, but in our breakout sessions, we're going to get more into some of the new papers that came out at SGO and are coming out at ASCO. But just a couple of them. And one to start with you, Katie, the one that was mentioned already, the SOLO 2 trial showing survival benefit. That's going to be presented at ASCO. Can you just talk a little bit, Katie, about kind of what you think that means to the field in general?
It's a big deal. I think this is one of the big criticisms of maintenance. People that don't like maintenance kind of are like, well, what's the overall survival advantage? And maybe I should just sequence things and use PARP later. This is the unadjusted hazard ratio is what's in the abstract. I have not seen the slides. I'm not an investigator on SOLO 2, so I've seen what you've seen. But the unadjusted hazard ratio for crossover. So it doesn't just pull out the people that didn't get crossover and that's positive, it's everybody. And the crossover was 35%. And there's still an unprecedented improvement overall survival with use of olaparib in that setting. So I think it's the first, we should see NOVA soon. So that'll be in beyond BRCA. I'm very interested in that data, and I don't know again when that will be out. But I mean, this really should, for that particular population, which is BRCA-associated cancers, they should all be getting it in the front line. But for those women that were treated before SOLO-1 and they've recurred, there should be no question about how you treat those patients anymore. I mean, it just should not even be a question on a test.
You know, one of the things, Neil, that's really challenging us is, and this is a good thing, is that OS has remarkably changed in the background. So we are doing so much better now than we did even 5 years ago. And it's really reflected in the prevalence data that I think I shared before. But Katie's right. So all these studies, we assumed that we would have readouts, even in the wild type patients, we thought we'd see readouts by now. Ain't happening. These patients are doing so much better. And so we're hoping that these will start to mature, but I know that both that NOVA and Ariel 3 are both, still waiting for events.
Mm-hmm. And, Rob, you brought this up, in the past, when you were first starting to note it. I thought it was so fascinating. The fact that the prevalence of ovarian cancer is increasing.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. So, we always talked about what percentage of patients go to each line of therapy. We've been talking about for at least 2 decades. I remember I have slides in different colored formats from years ago that we talked about that. But it's occurred to me that, that the percentage of patients that were actually recurring over a specific time, over a certain amount of time, was actually getting longer and longer and longer. And so I got out of the back of the napkin and just kind of calculated what I thought it was going to be for 5 years. and came up with a number around, you know, 180, 200,000. And I thought that was a really high number. So I went looking for it. And in the SEER, on the SEER website, in the statistics section, there's an area there that actually tracks prevalence estimated. And you can do it by 5 years, 10 years, or all in over the longer time period. And right now, and I've tracked it over for multiple years now, and you can see in one of the slides I've made that the prevalence now is 230,000, and it's changed by about 20% in the last 5 years. So what that tells you is that all of this work that we're doing, all the stuff that you're highlighting tonight, is leading to the fact that these patients are living longer, even though we may not be curing that many more, but we are definitely keeping them around longer so they can get the next best thing.
I want to thank our faculty for joining us tonight. I invite you all to come on Wednesday. We're going to talk about checkpoint inhibitors with another great faculty. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Beyond the Guidelines, PARP inhibitors and the management of ovarian cancer.